Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago tomorrow, January 20th, 1961, 43-year-old John F. Kennedy was sworn into office as President of the United States. On a famously bright, cold day on the steps of the Capitol, he gave an inaugural speech that instantly electrified the nation. It was a tough speech in the heart of the Cold War, but it is remembered mainly for its inspiring power, and above all, for this line.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
50 years on, that call still rings, still pulls. But what did it mean then? And how do we hear it? How does it sound today? This hour on Point, President John F. Kennedy's Ask Not speech, 50 years on, you can join the conversation. Does it still move you? To what? Does it still fit our political calculus, our idea of American citizenship today? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear later this hour from David Brooks of the New York Times, but first today in Washington is Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball and The Chris Matthews Show. He's a longtime Kennedy observer, former Peace Corps volunteer, notable on this day when Sergeant Shriver has died, a top aide back in the day to House Speaker Tip O'Neill, a speechwriter for President Carter. His books include Life's a Campaign and Kennedy and Nixon. Chris Matthews, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here today.
It's good to be on your show, Tom.
And with us from Colchester, Vermont, is Thurston Clark, writer and historian. He's author of Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Thurston Clark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Chris Matthews, take us back. You were 15, I think, on that day. Do you remember it?
I remember it well. I was in my recreation room, we used to call them back in the 50s, mm-hmm. in the basement in northeast Philadelphia, right up near Bucks County, and my mom was ironing in the basement watching, and I was watching it with her. And I never knew how my mom voted. I always wondered. We're a Republican family, and I couldn't tell because she was extremely Irish Catholic. And we had different arguments about this, about what should predominate our religion or our family's politics. And I've always wondered, and I still don't know exactly what happened in that voting booth.
All these years later, how many times, Chris, do you think you've heard that line, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country? And what has it meant?
I think it means a couple of things. Obviously, it's a call to duty. And it worked so well with the special forces. Of course, it had a dark side with Vietnam. It had so much to do with the Peace Corps, of course, and especially its early volunteers. But in it was a very Machiavellian transaction that's being offered there. Machiavelli figured out that if you give something to someone, if you volunteer something, if you invest in another person by giving them something, that you become invested in them and you become very much their vassal in many ways. You become so much a person whose life depends on that other person. And once you invested in the Kennedys, whether you worked for them in 1946 in the first House race or in the Senate race or in the President's race, and you got one of those PT-109 tie clips, you became a Kennedy person. And the genius of that transaction wasn't what the Kennedys did for you, but what you did for the Kennedys. And in doing so, became a Kennedy person, a loyalist for life. And they kept asking. Someone once said when they joined the Peace Corps, I came across this recently, I may have been in Thurston's book. I think it was in Thurston's book, where she said, no one had ever asked me before. And I just was overwhelmed by that offer, that it was really an offer to ask someone to do something for them. I mean, Ben Franklin once said, if you want to make a friend, ask someone to do you a favor. And it goes way back to Machiavelli and this notion of the transaction. So asking was a brilliant, brilliant political move, as well as a wonderfully idealistic call to duty.
We're going to hear it in just a second at some length, the context around it in that famous speech. Many call it one of the greatest political speeches of the 20th century. But Thurston Clark was at the call, invest in the Kennedys. It sounds like invest in the country.
You have to remember that the country at the time, government at the time, was thought to be a benevolent, a force for good. The 50s had seen the GI Bill. It had sent millions of veterans to college. The government had built the interstate highway system. The government had won World War II. So we didn't have the same feeling about the government we do now. Kennedy also had excellent political antenna, and he understood that this was something that people wanted to hear. Don't forget, this was just 3 years after Sputnik, after the Russians beat us to space with Sputnik. People were terribly worried. There was also a feeling that we'd kind of lost our way. There were a lot of conferences on the national purpose. There was this whole idea that America needed to somehow be renewed, that otherwise we were going to lose the Cold War. Very interesting survey was done in Look magazine just a few months before Kennedy gave this speech. And they polled a lot of college students then. And the college student, the summary was that the college students wanted purpose. They wanted to sacrifice. And they offered them whatever, they gave them a list of all these goodies. And they said, you can pick one thing. What do you want? 2% of them wanted a car. 64% said they wanted to get a PhD.
Wow, that's another time. But yeah, but also another question, you say right away, you know, people had a more friendly, more admiring attitude toward government. But of course, the words themselves are what you can do for your country. I want to ask about that as well. But let us hear the president once again after all these years. This is worth hearing. Chris Matthews, it's so good to have you, and Thurston Clark, who wrote the book on it. Let's listen back. Sit back here. This is a couple of full couple minutes here of JFK. He's on those bright, clear, snow-covered Washington, cleared for him, of course, but very snowy, cold day, no hat, 43 years old, youngest ever elected. Teddy Roosevelt had been 42 when he stepped in after an assassination, but youngest ever elected, no top hat on, and here he is. This is the summation. This is the last few graphs where you'll hear that line of JFK's inaugural speech.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice, which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
John F. Kennedy on his inauguration day, January 20th, 1961. And wow, is that a way back machine? And what powerful words. Thurston Clark wrote the book, Ask Not. The response was electric right across the spectrum. He quotes Barry Goldwater famously saying, God, I'd like to be able to do what that boy did there. A kind of conservative compliment. Archibald MacLeish writing it left him proud and hopeful to be an American. Thurston, you write of all kinds of people who felt the energy in that, of all the careers that were shaped by it. Chris, yes. What is your sense of how the country understood what Kennedy was asking when he asked, you know, what you can do for your country? How was that received? What did people hear?
Well, he had come off of a very, obviously, close election with Richard Nixon. And it was a very much the Cold Warrior campaign, with each of them trying to show that they would be the best champion of the country in fighting the Soviets and taking on that challenge that had become so immediate with the taking over of Cuba and, of course, the launching of Sputnik. As Thurston pointed out, there was this sense we were slipping in the Cold War.
The hour of maximum danger, he says there, yeah.
And I think that Kennedy was saying, I'm glad to be here. I want this job. It was like Churchill grabbing the premiership in 40 from Chamberlain, who really didn't want to fight the war. Here's a guy that wanted to fight it. And Kennedy was saying, great, give me the job. And I think it was a speech that Nixon would have loved to have given, and because it was so Cold War, it was so tough. But yet, if you read it carefully, it was very sensitive to the threat of a nuclear war, very sensitive to the need for eventual arms control, that nobody was going to win a nuclear war. And so it had to be a balance between aggressive defense and an offer of to negotiate, which was very much in the words, not to fear to negotiate. And so we had to do a balance. But I think the main message was strength and excitement to take on the challenge.
But was it, Thurston, we've just got half a minute here before the break, was it go to work for the government, or was it the kind of thousand points of light, do something for your country, whatever it may be?
I think it was both. I think that people, when they thought of their country, then they identified it more with the government, particularly the World War II generation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the effect has spilled on beyond the government. I think people looked at it as a larger call to service, that stirring line, a glow from that fire can light the world.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't want to be part of that glow that can light the world? Who doesn't want to answer that call?
Or who didn't, anyway, as we understood it then? We're looking at how we hear it today, the Ask Not speech of JFK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about President John F. Kennedy's great Ask Not speech on his inauguration day, 50 years ago tomorrow, January 20th, 1961. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And looking at how that sentence, that line, that exhortation resonates or doesn't today, MSNBC's Chris Matthews is with us from Hardball and the Chris Matthews Show. Thurston Clark is with us as well. He's the author of Ask Not, the Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. Of course, that's not all there was to it. There are many famous lines here. Let's listen right here. It was Cold War days.
Let every nation know whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Big and much history ensued from exactly that impulse, but all these years later, 50 years now, it's Ask Not, the Ask Not line that sticks with us. Chris Matthews, ask not what your country can do for you. You can almost see that as a placard at a Tea Party rally.
Well, it struck me at the time as a kid as a conservative line, because you have to remember back then as well as today, people, part of the political debate was how much of it was the dole, how much were people out there exploiting their poverty, if you will, to get federal money, to get welfare money.
But this was way before the Great Society.
It's the welfare party that gave out the giveaway money, handouts, if you will. The Republicans, that was their main charge against them. They were getting minority votes, if you will, by giving away money from the federal till. And here was a Democrat coming along and saying, don't ask for more welfare money. Ask whether you can sign up and do something for your country. It had a very tough conservative ring, but also I'm sure today the libertarians would say, what do you mean? The government exists for the people. You're not there for the government. So they could take it the other way and say this has a fascistic sound to it. So it has a lot of ring. I think at the time the ring was a relatively conservative note for a Democrat.
And ask what you can do for your country, Thurston Clark. You know, on the other hand, that hardly seems like it would fly. As Chris says, with libertarians, maybe the Tea Party Day, it's more like back off entirely, government. It's the land of liberty, me.
I agree. In fact, it's been criticized in the last 10 or 15 years in various blogs, and I've read critiques on the right of that line saying that we have no responsibility to the government. The libertarian thing is that we're paying our taxes. What else was this government – should they ask for us?
But isn't patriotism more than paying taxes?
I agree.
Chris, I mean, where is that line today between individual liberty, and that's what it's all about, and – that's what you can do for your country.
Well, it's always going to be the American debate, and I think the fact we're having this conversation now is a good day to have it. And I think there's always that question. But I'll tell you, when I first started working in Washington, I had a job as a Capitol policeman, which was a great patronage job. You did it at night so you could work in the office in the daytime. Mike Barnicle did it. And yeah. I met a working-class guy from the country, and we were talking about the protesters out there that were out beyond the Capitol rim there that were against the war. And I'd just gotten back from the Peace Corps, and I was very much against the war. But he said to me, you know what, the little man loves his country because it's all he has. And I've never forgotten that. The little man loves his country because it's all he has. And the proudest boast of any working guy who's out there maybe doing the lamb, I mean on the lamb, but poor in his 50s or 60s, is that he served his country in his youth. That sense of having committed, having given to the country is so profoundly emotional with people, so deep in their souls, and to have served your country. So I don't think the Tea Party has it if that's what they think is American, which is gimme. I think the American people love their heroes. They don't love war. We're not I hope we're not a warlike country, but we certainly love our heroes, whether it's Audie Murphy or it's George Washington. We look to these people as people who did what they had to do, for their country.
Did it during World War II.
If the Tea Party says every man for himself or every woman for himself, they're going to miss the boat.
But the little man, I mean, here was John F. Kennedy, you know, scion of a very wealthy family. Yep. I mean, he was hardly the little man. And of course, in those words, in that call, the poem that Robert Frost was supposed to read before all that snow reflection got in his eyes, as you quote right at the top of your book, Thurston, he was anticipating this, a golden age of poetry and power of which this noonday is the beginning hour, that inauguration day. Yeah. That was a call from the top.
That was, I think, just to go back for a minute to Ask Not, because I think we have to look at it in the context of World War II. Kennedy, 15 years earlier, the end of the war, Kennedy was speaking also to his generation, who had sacrificed for their country. That was the whole context of this. And also the reason that this line had such credibility coming from Kennedy is when he said this, they looked at a man who had sacrificed for his country. He was a decorated war hero. He'd lost his own brother in World War II. There's an earlier line in which he says the graves of young Americans who answered the call to service surround the globe. Well, among the graves was Joe Kennedy and the two crewmen from PT-109. So I think you have to see that some of the emotional reaction to this speech, particularly by Kennedy's generation, came from the World War II generation who saw him as their representative and someone who had done just that. He had asked not.
We've got all kinds of reaction here online. David in Tennessee says, ask not what your country can do for you is exactly what this country needs. Here's another from Wisconsin. Corey says, it has no meaning today for a mostly self-absorbed and selfish society. It's another commenter says, who speaks and comprehends like this anymore? One wonders why the dumbing down in America's moneyed individual set is greater than it is for the average American. I wonder, let's get our callers in here. Framingham, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Richard.
Hi. Well, I went to JFK Elementary in 1965 and saw that Ask Not statement every day I walked into school.
Yeah.
And then when I got to college, they handed us the Milton Friedman books, and I remember being struck that the first line in his book, Capitalism Freedom, was what a horrible statement this was, that it expressed no proper relationship between a citizen and his government, that we should neither be the wards nor the beneficiaries of government. And I think that is still the debate now. I think that we are always going to struggle with this question, whether we're part of a larger community or whether government just serves as a means to allow us to pursue our own individual goods.
That's it. Let us go at that, Richard. There's JFK on the Capitol steps and Milton Friedman in the textbook saying no, thank you. One more right here from Frankfort, Kentucky. Wren, thanks for calling, Wren. You're on the air.
Hello. I was there that day. First, I heard the speech at the Capitol. I was with my dad, who was an Army general. And then we followed the parade up in front of the reviewing stand where President Kennedy was at. There was no security hardly at all in those days.
Yeah, wow.
And we watched the parade coming up Pennsylvania Avenue past the White House, and it was all military. It was a very, very strong message being sent. And the most striking part of that whole thing, and it was tanks, and there was cannons, and it looked like a May Day parade, like we saw in Red Square every year. And the most striking thing for me was they had a gigantic globe coming on a trailer, a parade, and it was a huge world. And when the world got in front of President Kennedy, it shot out ICBM missiles.
Wow.
To all the crowd, little foam missiles about 7 to 8 inches long, and I caught one, and I still have it.
What did your father say to you on that day, Wren?
He said to me, he says, it's going to be your turn next. This is what you're going to be, this is my future. And as it turned out, I became very vocal against the Vietnam War, I'm a war protester, and my father and I actually broke over that, and we didn't have much of a relationship after that because I became one of those commie pinko hippy-dippy.
But you were there on that day and caught a foam intercontinental ballistic missile. It's an incredible picture, Wren. I really appreciate your painting it for us. Thurston, I mean, many people have remembered this as a hardcore Cold War speech. You're one of the people who says, no, peace also at the heart of it, but there was that was the time.
Oh, yes, it was. But I think that sometimes we key too much on that very poetic Churchillian, we'll pay any price, bear any burden, which has the rhythms of Churchill's, we'll fight them on the beaches, etc. I point out in my book that the American newspapers at the time reacted to the speech quite differently. They saw it as an invitation to reduce Cold War tensions. And the headlines on January 21st were, for example, Kennedy is sworn in, asks Grand Alliance for Peace, San Francisco, Washington Post, and Herald Tribune, takes oath as president, proclaims new quest for peace, Philadelphia. Kennedy asks world peace quest. You know, after the pay any price, bear any burden line, the rest of the speech is a cautionary one about the atom bomb, the dark powers of destruction of the atom, the spread of the deadly atom. And then there are those two crucial lines, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Only when our arms are sufficient without doubt can we be certain without doubt they'll never be used. I like to say that Kennedy was a cold warrior. This speech was a response to a very tough speech of Khrushchev's 2 weeks earlier, but he was somewhat of a nonviolent cold warrior. Throughout his presidency, he didn't pay any price or bear any burden. In Laos, in Berlin, the Cuban Missile Crisis, again and again, he went against his advisors and took the non-confrontational route.
Of course, there was that Little Bay of Pigs incident. There was a lot of language of high frontier in here also. Let's get just a little bit of that beyond the endless twilight struggle. You can hear the energy and excitement of that speech at that time.
Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce.
Explore the stars, encourage the arts. That's another time. Ken, Saranac Lake, New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Thanks for taking me. Well, I'm thinking Kennedy's line, I think we've lost it a little bit. It was never asked, ask what you can do for your government. It was asked, ask what you can do for your country. I think we've started to equate too much that our government is the be-all and end-all, where I believe Kennedy was saying, help your neighbor, help your friend. If we can help our government as well, that's great. But I think our mindset has shifted a little bit into too large of a government where that's the only mechanism to get things done, and I don't think that was Kennedy's message.
Ken, I appreciate your call. Chris Matthews, how about it? You know, do something for the government or 1,000 points of light kind of help your neighbor message here?
Well, I don't think he delineated it, but I think at the time, I think Thurston's right. He was a World War II guy, and we were coming off of a pretty good 20 years there of effective government. Winning World War II was a lot, and of course, the Marshall Plan. And everything seemed to be, if you look at the Wall Street Journal polling back then, 75% of the people said the government could do what it set out to do. Well, that number, of course, has degraded dramatically in our lifetime. We just don't think the government can achieve even the goals it sets for itself. I don't think Kennedy was anti-government like people are today. I think he had a positive view of public service. He never got a job in the private sector. His brothers didn't. I think he thought that was really a better way to spend your life than making more money. Of course, he had all the money in the world to start with, so he had a unique situation. But by the way, Thurston's book is really good. I must say, I've been reading through it, and there's so much rich background there about everything we're talking about here. It's not just the words, but the wonderful context. And I just remember something about the time. Thurston may not have remembered. I'm a movie buff like a lot of us. And I remember that great Alfred Hitchcock film, North by Northwest, which is one of my favorites. And there's a wonderful conversation in it between Cary Grant and Leo G. Carroll. Leo G. Carroll's playing an FBI agent who's tracking a sort of an Alger Hiss-type character played by James Mason. And Eva Marie Saint is playing this woman who's become kind of an undercover agent, but she's serving as mistress to this communist, this agent. And Cary Grant says, well, if we have to have women do something like this for our country, maybe we ought to lose the Cold War. And Leo G. Carroll, in this thrilling, stirring line, just coldly says to him, I'm afraid we're already doing a good job of that.
Losing.
That was stated as a fact in like 1957, 58. And I believe that was the sense, that we were losing Sputnik and Cuba and the U-2 flight and a lot of things, and the numbers we were getting from the Soviet Union in terms of production and throw weight and the size of their missiles. We were getting a scary sense that we were losing the Cold War. And that's why this speech, this gripping speech on that cold day in January, was a statement, damn it, we're not going to lose this thing. I'm a young guy, we're going to do our best, and we're not going to have a war. It's not going to be a war. We're going to find a peaceful way to compete with the Soviets.
And we're going to win no matter how long it takes. Well, but Chris, let me ask you, though, because we've got the president of China in Washington right now, and you know darn well a lot of people are thinking the same thing now. We're losing it to China on green tech, on economic growth. It's their century. You know, does that mean this speech could work now? If not, what? If not this,
well, don't
Chris.
Compare the two. We're not hiding under our desks.
Well, no, but we've got a lot of people out of work.
Come on. This don't equate the feeling of economic competition with the Chinese to what we feared back in the 50s when we grew up fearing a real nuclear war.
Well, no, you're right. I don't want to equate the mortal threat, but the sense of our national standing definitely seems challenged by China today. And the consequences of not being on top economically, we feel them right now. They're serious. I mean, what about a call like this today, Chris? Would it work?
I don't think it's the same. I think the dire straits we felt we were heading into in terms of war, nuclear war, just doesn't have any comparison to a sense, all right, we'll be number two in GDP total, but I don't think we are going to be that. But the sense that we're going to have to compete with a country that can match us in production, that's not a terribly unhealthy thing as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't mind sharing some of the wealth in the world and having other countries that can do what we're doing. I don't know. It isn't to me. It isn't the Super Bowl as far as I'm concerned.
I agree.
Thurston?
I'd like to agree with Chris. Growing up in a suburb of New York in the late 1950s, I was 10, 11, 12. I was terrified whenever there was a big – I imagined the big flash I'd see from New York, and that would be the end of my father. Thought about this all the time. My friends and I, we used to talk about this, how much time we'd have, and would your father survive? And because all our mothers were stay-at-home mothers, but the fathers were all in New York City. I remember that as a constant fear growing up.
Does the poetry still work today, Chris? Thurston has said, you know, Obama kind of ducked the high poetry in his inaugural speech. There was some there, but not on this scale. Does it still work?
Well, I thought he did with his speech in Boston in 2004 and again a couple of times during the campaign. I think he does have a touch of it, and I think that calling to service, though, I don't think he's done that yet, and I think that's a missing ingredient here. I think people want to be asked.
Chris Matthews with MSNBC's Hardball and The Chris Matthews Show, author of Kennedy and Nixon and most recently of Life's a Campaign. It's great to have you back, Chris. Thank you very much for being with us today.
What a great day.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President John F. Kennedy's Ask Not speech on his inauguration day, 50 years ago tomorrow. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Asking how that sentence, that exhortation, resonates or does not today. Thurston Clark has been with us, author of Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. In just a moment, David Brooks joins us as well of the New York Times. Let's listen to one more piece of the speech, and we'll bring in David Brooks. Here's the president, the newly inaugurated president, describing the forces that shaped what then was the what he called the new generation of Americans.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
John F. Kennedy on the steps of the Capitol on that bright, snowy, cold day, January 1961. David Brooks joins us now from Washington, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. His new, next, forthcoming book out in March is The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. David Brooks, welcome back to One Point. Thanks very much for being here today.
Good to be with you again.
So how does this great phrase, ask not, ask what, how does it last? How does it linger? How does it resonate or not today for you, David?
Well, it lingers as a beacon of nostalgia, but the context is different, unfortunately, in many ways, in bad ways, and I can think of three differences.
Mm-hmm.
One, when Kennedy uttered those words, if you ask people, do you trust government to do the right thing most of the time, I suspect somewhere around 70 or 80% would say yes. Now the number is closer to 19 or 23%. So there's been a sea change in trust in government and trust in institutions. The second thing, and it's in that passage you just played, was tempered by war and disciplined. His was a generation which had been through war and had been affected by it and was sort of hard-headed about it. I don't think we have a generation now, with the possible exception of the Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans,
mm-hmm.
who feel that same sense, I've been disciplined, I've been toughened, I'm ready to govern. And so I think some of the self-confidence is down. And then finally, since that speech was delivered, we've had two individualistic revolutions, a sort of a social individualistic revolution in the 60s
mm-hmm.
and an economic individualistic revolution in the 80s, both of which downgraded the importance of groups and upgraded the importance of individual self-exploration. And so there's less common purpose. The country hungers for something like that, but the context has changed dramatically and in some ways for the worse.
What does it mean if a country can't rise to a line like that, though? I mean, at some level, there's a lot of complexity in there, but in some level, it sounds so very simple. Don't ask for too much from your country, but see what you can contribute. I mean, that goes, as Thurston Clark writes, that goes all the way back to, was it Thurston, Pericles?
Yes. I mean, the antecedents of that line, there are a number of them. Oliver Wendell Holmes, their speeches. It's not a new idea. It wasn't new for Kennedy. It was articulated very well by him, but it wasn't it wasn't some idea that he stumbled on.
I mean, ironically, you say it may also have come from his headmaster at the elite prep school, Choate. Don't ask what Choate can do for you. Ask what you can do for Choate.
Yeah, I don't know if it was exactly those words,
but that is
seen to be one of the sources of it. There were a number of sources. A lot of the sources. That line really came out of a lot of extemporaneous remarks that Kennedy made during the campaign, and Sorensen heard them and began incorporating them into a speech.
Ted Sorensen, so his speechwriter, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But David, if we can't grasp that sort of ancient exhortation for an individual's relationship to their country, what does that mean?
It's a problem. There are two things here. One is the elite thing and the way Kennedy was raised. You know, he and his generation would have been raised reading Pericles' funeral oration, which is, to me, probably the greatest speech ever given. And there's a great book called The Wise Men, which is about sort of the Eastern establishment in those days. And one of the fathers of one of the characters, a guy named John McCloy, his father on his deathbed, his last words were, have John learn Greek. And the idea was if you're raising people for leadership, they should be familiar with this literature and with the Greek, with Plutarch and with the Greek lives and Roman lives. And that's an education that somewhat been lost. But the harder problem is, how do you ask people to to share in a sacrifice and to share sacrifice when they feel, well, if the government does it or if corporations ask me to do it, I'm just going to get the shaft,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to get all the benefits, and I'm going to get nothing out of it, so why should I sacrifice?
Was that a line for a country with a great, big, healthy middle class? Is that part of the problem now, David?
Well, I think that may be part of it. I just think for a whole number of reasons, we have less social trust than we used to, and Robert Putnam has written a great deal about that. If you want me to explain why there's less social trust, I would say part it's Vietnam, part it's Watergate. Part it's also we're more pleased with ourselves, and so we trust ourselves more, or at least think more highly of ourselves, and feel less dependent on larger institutions. But rebuilding that level of social trust seems to me absolutely essential. And so you can give a speech like that, and I think Obama has given speeches like that, delivering means actually rebuilding the social bonds that Kennedy and his generation could more or less take for granted.
It's fascinating how the tumblers in our mind have changed just enough that the key doesn't fit quite perfectly. We've got lots of response online here. Here's Chris in New York. Glenn Falls says he's in his early 30s, wasn't there, but that famous line still makes me emotional, he writes. Unfortunately, it's born out of loss and grief, that emotion, he says. I'm disgusted in my country's selfishness and corruption. Shannon in Tennessee, I was in first grade when JFK made that speech. I thought about the ask not part a lot. To me, it never meant service to government. It meant service to the country, the land, and its people. There's a kind of post-Reagan, interpretation. Let's get a caller from Omaha, Nebraska. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call in real quick and let you guys know there's a lot of us out here. I work two jobs. My wife works two jobs. Pretty much everybody I know is working two jobs or looking for a second job. The ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country resonates now more than ever. There are so many people out there hurting. It's time to pay the piper. What I take from it is that there is a lot more that we could be doing to help. And you guys keep using the same phrase, middle class. Well, we should just throw that one out right now because we're talking about, the 99 percentile down to zero. It's pretty much the have and the have-nots.
But what does it mean to you, Dave? Does it mean help your neighbor, the family next door? Does it mean chip in through your government?
Definitely help your neighbor. You know, the government is going to be there no matter what. We've done a pretty good job of setting them up. They're going to be there, through whatever comes. But the people is what we seem to be forgetting about. 9 times out of 10, you talk about the corporations and whatnot and people giving money to them and getting the shaft. Well, that's the growing consensus, but you can't let that kind of pessimistic attitude rule how you work your life, how you deal with individuals.
Dave, we hear it, and I love your perspective there. I really love it. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more from Kristiansand, Norway. Mark in Norway, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes. What do you
show? Listen to it every day.
Oh, great.
A couple of points. First, I agree with the last guy who was calling. You can't equate government and country. America is so much more than the government. It's the values that the country's been built on, and it's the people, it's the neighbors. And that's what Kennedy was calling us to serve. It's not so much a call to duty, but a call to service, with all the wonderful benefits that come from serving somebody else. If we had a little bit more service, I don't think we'd be in that banking crisis, the economic crisis, if some of the bankers had some of that same attitude.
Yeah, that sentiment is incredibly durable, and I appreciate that, Mark, in Norway. Let me get one more, and I'll take it back to David Brooks and Thurston Clark. Charlottesville, Virginia. Kim, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. As we're also sort of celebrating Sergeant Shriver's life today with his passing, I think we also need to sort of reflect on the large cadre of people we have out there who'd served in the Peace Corps who had gone back to school after serving and tried to work to get into some of these institutions or work on some of these issues that do plague our own nation and find it extraordinarily difficult to even provide that kind of perspective within the American society.
Yeah, Sergeant Shriver, the first founding director of the Peace Corps, of course, died yesterday at 95, right in the middle of the Kennedy clan. And this high frontier movement of that time. I mean, David Brooks, you hear that range of sentiment right there. People don't want to give up on this idea. They want to find a new manifestation of it.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not a pessimist about American culture at all. I think if you look at most social indicators, they're pointing to the right direction. If you look at
activism and community involvement, especially among people under 35, I find it's astonishingly high, probably historically high, the number of people who are performing some sort of community service. And so I wouldn't be pessimistic about that. I think we do face a concrete problem, which is we have a budgets both at the state and the federal level, which where we've simply promised things we can't afford. And so now when you ask about shared sacrifice, when you ask about giving back, a large piece of that has to be giving back maybe some of the Medicare benefits that were promised to us. Those of us who own homes have to say, can the country really afford the mortgage interest deduction that I'm getting? And there are various other deductions that we take advantage of, spending promises that we've made, and that were simply unaffordable. And so do we trust the system enough to make those cuts, which are inevitable, but to make them fairly? To me, that's the core sacrifice that we're going to be facing starting this month and probably for the next 10 years or so.
Thurston, you wrote the book on this. How do you think JFK would respond to that? I mean, after all, he was a Democrat. It was much closer to FDR in those days than now. But then it was pre-LBJ, pre-Great Society, when he said, ask not what your country can do for you. Is that a wind-down Social Security line?
No, I don't think so. I think we have to look at Kennedy, of course, was, as we all are, affected by his times. And he grew up at a time when people were accustomed to sacrificing in war and in the Depression. Of course, the Depression didn't touch the Kennedys. But this was the context that sacrifice wasn't seen as an extraordinary thing, that suddenly people were very comfortable and the government was coming saying, well, now it's time to sacrifice. People were used to sacrificing. And I think that Kennedy is often painted as someone who was skeptical. He was skeptical about the ability of a government to accomplish everything. He was not a kind of Hubert Humphrey kind of liberal, but he did believe in the federal government could be a force for good. And
let's not make it that abstract. I guess I would say we're talking about whether the rate of increase for Medicare spending will go up 10% a year or 6% mm-hmm. a year. So mm-hmm. that's actually the call to sacrifice that's being asked.
Let's go to Jason calling from Boston. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hey, hi. How you doing?
Pretty well.
Yeah, I just got a little comment to make on JFK for what he have done for a lot of people, including me. I'm from Liberia. One of the major progress that we have from JFK is the hospital that he built through the Peace Corps, and that went a long way for a lot of Liberians who was born in the 60s, the 70s, and it's still the hospital still stand and is doing more good for Liberians. So that's one of the things I never knew that I was going to come to America and be in Boston to see how JFK helped the Liberians.
Jason, I really appreciate that on this of all days with Sergeant Shriver just gone from us, that kind of testimony of what it meant on the ground in your African country, and I appreciate that. One more here, Wren in Northfield, Vermont. Wren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just want to say I sort of think that since Vietnam, I think, was the start of people losing their faith in the government serving them, the government's role is supposed to even the playing field, and I think instead the government has been servicing that gap between the rich and poor and making the playing field more in the favor of the rich. And so it sort of forced the common man to have to be each person for himself because the government isn't doing their job, and so everyone has to take care of themselves. And so to ask what we're going to do now to support the government is sort of like they lost that chance for us to be fair with each other.
Wow. There's the government, there's the country, and there's certainly the need for us to pitch in. I've got one more little clip here from JFK himself. The civility word is here, and negotiation. He was talking about the Soviet Union and the United States, but there's an interesting resonance here today. One last bit from that inaugural speech.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
Might not be a bad sentiment as Republicans move into the House. David Brooks, what do you think we can most beneficially pull forward from this speech? Here we are 50 years later. What can we most you know, what works for us here? What can we bring forward and really use now?
Patriotism, I think. You know, one of the things Pericles did in the speech we mentioned earlier was really define what it meant to be an Athenian. And I think what Kennedy did was define for a post-war era what it meant to be an American, a sort of a compassionate but vigorous and in some ways combative style. And if we're going to make sacrifices, which I think we do need to make, to give up some of our deduction, to give up some of our cost of living benefits, then I think the only reason you would do that is because you love your country more than your mortgage tax deduction, and you're willing to make that sacrifice, and you're going to say, if people are, you know, losing their lives in Afghanistan, am I really not going to take a 1% cut in my Medicare, especially if you're earning $80,000 to $100,000 a year? And so, you know, I do think that unabashed, confident style of patriotism is really what rallies people to be willing to sacrifice.
Thurston Clark, would it work again? Does it still work? We're listening today. Do you think it still moves Americans?
I think it would work. I think a speech like this would work. I think that the takeaway from this speech for me is that words matter, that rhetoric is important, that great speeches can have a tremendous effect on the course of history, and that eloquence is a virtue and not a vice.
You quote Pericles in your prologue here, "The whole earth is the sepulcher of famous men, and their story is graven not only on stone over their native earth, but lives on far away without visible symbol, woven into the stuff of other men's lives." Maybe that's where this speech lives now, there, and as you remind us, on JFK's grave at Arlington Cemetery. Thurston Clark, author of Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And David Brooks, whose new book, The Social Animal, comes out in March, op-ed columnist for The New York Times. David, thanks for your time. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Always a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.